Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
I've been reading the reports from the Department of Labor, and in light of that, in light of my experience with a lot of clients, marketing is among the fastest growing careers of all. And indeed, some marketing has value. For example, if I'm developing a new product, then I want to understand my customers' needs, and so I want to incorporate those in the new product. That's perfectly reasonable to bring marketing in right there early. That's a great thing to do. Or if I have a great new product that the public doesn't know about, of course, you know, if it could be the greatest product in the world, unless people know about it, they're not going to buy it. And I was just talking to my guest before, and it's true, especially in technical fields where there's a technical innovation, and the customer there are highly technical expert people. Of course, you need to be able to market it for them to understand, not just sell it, but really understand their needs. And, you know, so I am not going to argue today that marketing is this horrible, pure evil. That said, that kind of marketing is only a small percentage of the dollars spent on marketing overall net in this country and in the world. The vast majority is to get people to buy what they otherwise wouldn't and perhaps shouldn't. And usually, because it costs a lot for a company to market a product, not only does it raise the price of said product, disproportionately marketing is for products that are worse or provide worse value than the product they'd otherwise have bought. For example, the generic version of a drug versus the brand name version, or the used Toyota rather than the new Jaguar, Beamer, Mercedes. Now, I argued this point that marketing is a net evil on this very radio program. And one of the listeners happened to be Gordon Swartz. Who's Gordon Swartz? Gordon Swartz is the dean of the business school at Golden Gate University. And he emailed me and he proposed debating me on this issue, whether marketing is a net evil. And I, despite that, I mean, this guy, you can wait to hear his credentials, like a fool, I agreed. Who is Gordon Swartz? He holds a Doctor of Business Administration from Harvard, an MBA from Northeastern University, one of the premier places for practical education on the East Coast, and a bachelor's degree in nuclear engineering and political science from MIT. He was the associate dean of executive education at Georgetown. And then it's not like he's just been the ivory tower. He was vice president for MarketBridge, where he led major marketing, sales strategy, and transformation efforts for Fortune Global 500 companies. And now he's dean of Golden Gate University School of Business. Am I crazy or what? Gordon Swartz, welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Thank you.
Well, he and I talked a little bit before about how this we're going to have this debate. And we decided that, you know, unlike in commercial TV or radio where it needs, you know, 60-second opening statements, we decided to give a little additional time. So it'll be 2.5 to 3 minutes worth of an opening statement for each of us. And he's going to start because he's taking the affirmative case in this debate that marketing is a net good. And I will take an equal amount of time afterwards to take the opposite side, that marketing is a net evil. Then we're not planning to do this, but right before we were planning to go and politely ask each other questions, and each would respond for 2 or 3 minutes or a minute or whatever. But we ended up before the show finding that our natural interaction style is more like we're having our third beer. So we're going to just chat interruptively, just like we were having beers or whatever, and talk about these issues, including stipulating when the other person has a good point, so that we are here to generate more light than heat. And then we'll make closing statements. And I promise you, I have not made up my closing statement in advance because I want to hopefully listen my butt off to what Gordon has said, and so that my closing statement is reflective of the interchange between the two of us. Is that a fair summary of what we've agreed?
Absolutely. And thank you very much for inviting me.
It's my pleasure indeed. Well, hopefully have fun. And you know, again, I'm obsessed with this idea that in the Bay Area, we have this echo chamber where we are intolerant of others' views, we are rude, we are close-minded. And hopefully, while we may or may not change our views even incrementally, I want to model what should be the constructive kind of clash of ideas that the university is supposed to be, and in theory, the media is supposed to be. And now I will shut up, and would you and please, Gordon Swartz, your opening statement as to why you think marketing is a net good.
Okay, thank you. And Marty, I really appreciate the opportunity to have a conversation with you. One of the one of the things that I thought as far as the ground rules would be that when we're talking about marketing being a net good or a net evil, one of the really important aspects is that we're talking about marketing and organizations that use marketing and sales tools and plans in an environment where we're really focusing on organizations that are not doing this unethically or dishonestly or engaging in illegal market activities. Right.
We can agree with that. Absolutely.
So when we talk about marketing, what is it that we're talking about marketing? You made the assertion that marketing, a small fraction of marketing, is really ethical, and that the vast majority of marketing is, in fact, unethical and manipulative. And at this time of the year, it wouldn't be surprising if people thought that Super Bowl advertising and celebrity endorsements were the things that are most illustrative of what marketing is. But these kinds of advertising and these kinds of endorsements, they're only a part of marketing. They're a small part of marketing. In many organizations, there's a small group. It's a unit that does these marketing and sales things, whatever they are. But to understand the value that marketing adds, what's really important is this idea that you were touching on, and I'm calling it the marketing concept. This is the idea that it is essential to be able to identify and understand and then to build an organization that puts together resources to satisfy in a socially responsible way, in a sustainable way, customers and consumers' stated and unstated needs. It's not always easy to be able to discover what those needs and wants are. And they can be very complex, and they have very different priorities and emphasis. And the model of what is important to those consumers is changing all the time. David Packard, who was one of the founders of Hewlett-Packard, he famously stated that marketing is too important to leave to the marketing department. And what he was intending by making that statement is that this marketing concept is really a key driver of creativity and innovation. It's critical to focus the organization's resources. We can think of examples in this community, Google Glass, Google Video, and so on, where enormous resources were expended on trialing of products, and it may have been more effective to have some marketing to make those things work effectively. So when you're talking about satisfying changing needs and wants, companies need to have many different decision processes to help get the right product to the right place at the right time and at the right price. And that market dynamic is part of providing enough information, whether it's through advertising, testimonials, samples, whatever, so that a customer can choose and make a wise choice. If any one of us tries to create a single model of what a good product is, we're going to miss the mark. We could end up with white, unflavored paste sold by the pound, and we can call it toothpaste. We'll have unscented liquid soap in 5-gallon barrels, and we'll call it shampoo. We'll have khaki-colored, machine-cut polyester outfits in every size, and we can call it fashion. But that's not what people want. People are diverse in their backgrounds, their communities, their genetic makeup, their likes and dislikes, their aspirations, and their values in their communities, and what drives their choices. And the beauty of this system is that the competitive marketplace, the communications that drive it, the innovations and change, that also drives down prices. These changes benefit consumers with new products and services, and over time, competition and lower prices. There's an old Radio Shack newspaper ad that's making the rounds of the internet. In this advertisement, there's a portable phone, a CB radio, an alarm clock, a pager, a radio, a music player, stereo headphones, and a radar detector. Altogether, these products add up to thousands of dollars of expenses for consumer products. Today, all of those functionalities are on a typical smartphone. That's the power of marketing, understanding consumers' needs and wants. No consumer said, "I want a smartphone that has all of these functions." But over time, the market research, the product innovation, drove the decisions to help organizations offer those and make people's lives better. It's also important to recognize that people don't always buy and consume products simply for the functional use of the product. What the consumer wants most may not be the generic product ingredients. unbranded aspirin, for example. What the consumer wants may be an easily recognizable container, a product that they have used before, a product in a specific package by size or with an easy opener safety top, a product that is a capsule, a tablet, a dissolvable fizzy drink, or a liquid, a product that is flavored or unflavored, and so on. And we can go on a long time. Consumers want diverse choices. Or even more, the consumer may really just want the ease and assurance of making a reliable, safe choice and being seen by others in their community that they're making a wise choice or something that is acceptable.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for your opening statement. Here is where I differ. First of all, to argue, I'll take a couple of specific examples that you gave, because we do, especially on the radio, we do better if we're dealing with the concrete. So you talked about smartphone, you talked about the aspirin. To argue that much of the credit for the smartphone and our being grateful to have that comes from marketing is garbage. In reality, it is from the brilliant technical engineers, the people who created them. The differences among the smartphones end up being relatively subtle, and they spend billions of marketing, which jack up the price of an Android versus smartphone of different brands to, you know, Herculean amounts, $700, much of which is spent in marketing. So to give, you know, to place the mantle of wonderfulness of the smartphone on marketing is garbage. Secondly, the difference between, you're talking about consumer choices to have a aspirin have a safety top. Well, they all have the same safety top. It's FDA mandated. There's no functional difference. And to say that people feeling a little more comfortable with this brand they knew is worth 700% more, and that's really true. I take a baby aspirin a day, like all many middle-aged or men or older take a baby aspirin to prevent a heart attack. It is exactly the same FDA formulation, and it costs one less than a penny, about a half a penny per pill, per FDA-approved aspirin, and 700% more to have the, quote, comfort of the brand name. It's not really what happens is marketing fans the flames of feeling the brand name is important and gets people to spend 700 times as much. Now, these are merely the examples you talked about. And we who are in the middle class can afford $8 for the aspirin rather than $3 for the aspirin. But the reality is for most of the people who are struggling, for whom it really does collectively, all the impact of all that marketing to get them to spend more than they should is really dangerous. So now, I'm doing my opening statement, and then we'll have an informal back and forth. Now, rationally, for example, I'll take other examples lest we stay focused on those. Rationally, most people should buy a used basic Toyota, rather, which is your metaphor for your white toothpaste or whatever it is, you know, your generic white toothpaste, rather than a new anything, let alone a Mercedes or a Beamer. It costs much less to buy a Toyota and is more reliable. What is a major reason we don't? Marketing. Millions and millions and literally probably billions of dollars on marketing. We know we should eat fruits and veggies, not processed foods. But do we offer enough? Yes, sometimes it's preference. But the fans of that, those preferences are fanned by the marketing people to get us to eat Taco Bell and other fast food and other processed foods that are brightly colored in the supermarket aisle. We know we should buy clothes based on looks and quality, but we often pay much more just because a designer label is slapped on it. Yes, there's some increased perceived value in, oh, I feel good about wearing, you know, the modern-day version of Jordache, Gloria Vanderbilt, Coach purses for $500, $800 Jimmy Choo shoes. Marketing. And we public radio listeners, and we're among the most sophisticated. Now think about all the vulnerable people we public radio listeners claim to care about. Beyoncé took $50 million last year to flog sugary Pepsi to the very people she claims to care about. LeBron James took $90 million from Nike to get people to spend $100 to $300 bucks for a pair of sneakers that won't make anybody a better athlete than a $20 pair. Cigarette companies spend $4 billion a year to market to get people to smoke cancer sticks. These are not little aberrations. Marketing is one thing, but deceptive is another. And I stipulated in error in advance that we can't talk about deceptive marketing because it's huge. And I have to say, I looked at your website, Golden Gate University's School of Business website. I started by Googling, because I didn't know the address. I Googled Golden Gate MBA. This was just yesterday. And the title of the top result, this is a quote, top MBA degree program in the Bay Area, end quote. That, when I clicked on that, it took me to Golden Gate MBA program's homepage, which featured a badge saying not number one program, but number one program for adult students. So you hooked them in with the generic, and then it's the qualifier starts. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. In far smaller, faint gray print, it said the ranking was not done, what we might think, by U.S. News, not even by a Bay Area publication, but Washingtonian Magazine. Then I looked at the Washingtonian. Golden Gate was in the ranking for undergraduate programs, not MBAs. In its graduate rankings, Golden Gate wasn't even listed. They had, quote, best buys for regional or whatever. It wasn't even listed. Then when I looked at the criteria that Washingtonian Magazine used in the undergraduate rankings, Golden Gate did score excellent, not on student learning, which wasn't even measured, nor cost, where Golden Gate ranked 360th. Or even graduate earnings, it ranked 18th. It ranked highest on ease of enrollment, which actually could be a minus, lack of selectivity, flexibility, and adult services. Golden Gate top MBA, top Bay Area MBA program? Marketing. Deceptive marketing. Then I turned to tuition. The Golden Gate site says, it only says $2,925 per three-unit course. It didn't say the relevant number. I had to go and search and see how many units were required for the MBA. It turns out to be 54, more even than Berkeley. The cost of that, 54 units, $157,950 for a Golden Gate MBA. That's just $2,000 less than a Berkeley MBA. That's marketing. While my opponent can, of course, cherry-pick examples where marketing is an evil, and I stipulated some of them up front, net, marketing is evil. Now we can have our little informal conversation, and let's see whether we can continue to try to shed more heat, light than heat.
Okay, and I think that that's your example, particularly of Golden Gate University, is a really good one, which relates to how do people assess a product. And your model, for example, of assessing the utility of aspirin says you're going only by the functionality of the pill as opposed to the experience that a consumer may have had by having that particular capsule, or their preference for a different delivery format for that capsule, or their level of comfort for dealing with that capsule. And, you know, given my engineering degree, I'll kind of check a little bit of the math here. So 700% increase does not mean 700 times more expensive. So
correct.
The
sure.
The one penny pill that someone takes, or a half penny pill, if they're taking a branded product that they've taken before and that they're comfortable with and they like to buy that, it's 3.5 cents.
Seven cents.
Well, if it's a half penny for generic,
yeah, okay,
and it's 3.5. So this is not something that is going to prevent someone who can only afford to spend half a penny on a generic product from having access to aspirin. So that's a little bit of a false dichotomy by saying that someone is being forced from being able to take an aspirin that they need because there's a branded product which is available. And your choice, your ability to choose that product is actually evidence that the advertising that you're so berating doesn't work. That you're looking at that product and your model is, I am only looking for a product that has the chemical composition and I'm going to go for the lowest price. Someone else looks at that product and they choose different criteria.
Of course, in any individual item, if we reduce the unit of scale to the smallest amount, a single aspirin, which is the cheapest item possible, it in itself, it doesn't mean anything. But we're talking about the overall impact of marketing, everything from buying processed foods to your car to jewelry, to brands, to where you vacation, the collective sum total of that for the, especially for the vulnerable, which are the people that advertising is mainly, consumer advertising is mainly aimed at, because they know they are more subject to the impact of those, that manipulative advertising. The impact on their quality of life is huge. And right, to decry the fact that, you know, I focused on the functionality rather than the label. Right. Should we be can we really defend marketing by distracting people from the functionality to the label? Is that not emphasizing sizzle, not steak?
Well, I don't in fact think it's emphasizing the sizzle, not steak. I think it's emphasizing some of the other characteristics of the product that actually have meaningful value for people. So the fact that someone can find a product that they recognize on a shelf anywhere across the country is a convenience issue. If a generic that I don't recognize is not available and I don't have experience with it and I reach for that, I'm taking a little bit of a risk. I can have some assurance that there's a company that is recognizable that I can tie to that product. And it's sort of like entering a transaction with a known counterparty. So, for example, you're buying your generic product. You've got two bottles of it. You can go in the store and you can buy it in the store. You can buy it from someone who's standing on the sidewalk and saying, these are generic aspirin, and actually it's half the price of the bottle in the store. What would you do? Are you going to save a quarter of a penny and buy a product from an unknown source?
Well, take any of these products, and I don't want to just stay with aspirin because then I'm going to be guilty of cherry picking. But almost any product, whether it be canned peaches, Del Monte versus generic, or it be a no-name pair of sneakers that you get at Walmart or Target or whatever versus the brand, they're ubiquitous, whether it be on Amazon or it be in stores. Every store has, for a wide range of product, a generic at a fraction of the price, or a no-name, one that doesn't have billions of dollars spent. And so to argue that the additional availability of the brand name is worth 700% more, and that 700% is, in fact, not just limited to aspirin. It really does apply, for example, the most heavily marketed things like the shoes, the athletic shoes. The prices of – I'm shocked right now to see – when I was a kid, Nikes cost $30-$40. Now the Nike shoes that are getting advertised are $100-$300. These are not trivial differences compared – and I really did buy for $18.97 at Walmart a perfectly excellent pair of running shoes. And so we're really talking about very significant amounts and the availability and the reliability. It's not like these are crappy things. The FDA, for example, back to the drugs, generic drugs have to meet the exact same standard as the brand. 700% more for the label? That's why marketing is a problem, and it preys on the most vulnerable.
Well, I think you're also coming into a category of when you start to talk about athletic wear and you start to talk about real fashion decisions that people are making. And there is a high turnover in that industry in terms of the products and the styles that are relevant. And there is another set of characteristics aside from the size of the shoe and the fabric of the shoe or the materials making the tread of the shoe. There is the fashion aspect of it and the acceptance of people within the groups that they are seeking acceptance. They want to be seen as fashionable. They want to make a statement. And part of the value is to be able to associate with the superstar athletes or the fashion models or the other people who are defining what fashion is. And this extends to many other products that are used in terms of just day-to-day life and social interactions where people are making a statement in terms of their interactions with other people, whether it's on a sporting field or whether it's in the concert hall or whether it's at work.
Precisely. And marketing fans the flame of those shallow values. How many kids or aspire to be, they think, I'm going to wear these shoes and it makes me feel like a pro athlete. Or I'm going to wear a Rolex watch. And that's going to make me feel like I'm something of substance. Doesn't that encourage people to portray themselves as more sizzle than steak? Do we really want to defend marketing as something that promotes these shallow values, and lest we think that we're just talking about these discretionary items, let's take the most basic thing that every family wants, which is financial security, so they can afford Golden Gate University, so they can afford to retire, so they can afford to, the health care, the enormous copays that health insurance requires. Well, I read a New York, a University of Tennessee study that looked at mutual funds that advertised versus mutual funds that didn't. And despite the claims in the very, you know, that are made loud and clear, the actual performance of those that advertised was worse than those that didn't. That's not discretionary. Insurance. I, you know, watch CNN a fair amount. And I see Liberty Mutual as the ultimate and Progressive. Those are two of them. And I then did some research. I wrote an article on this issue for Time Magazine. They are among the most expensive of the insurers. And it's all they're spending billions on marketing, and including Geico, also with their stupid Gecko, which, again, is designed to appeal to the least among us, as the New Testament says. Can we really defend marketing when it's making people spend more for less?
Well, I think there again, you're cherry picking some examples where you've got companies that are offering products, and when you're doing a price comparison, you're saying they're more expensive. I'll tell you from personal experience, the ultimate in cherry picking. I have Geico insurance, and I've compared it on many occasions, and it happens to be a lower priced policy than many of the other companies that I've tried to compare it with.
You're not a good enough shopper.
And here's the challenge is that. The fact that those products are advertised and creating awareness for those products is not compelling anyone to choose them. Advertising has a relatively limited impact in terms of people's actual ultimate choice. And coming back to this issue of it's paternalistic, and it's also very, very, I think, demeaning to people who are in the marketplace and who are managing their money to suggest that it's a shallow value for someone to choose a car because they're not focusing on reliability and miles per gallon as you might, but they're focusing on style or performance, or they're focusing on the comfort of the cockpit that they're in when they are sitting in that car. Those are all things that are valid reasons and valid preferences for people to make a choice of the automobile that they want to drive. It's not necessarily driven by a single model of preference and value that says every car should be based, rated and valued based on its miles per gallon and its breakdown record, because there's a whole culture that builds up around the maintenance and care of cars. So there are certain cars that are, you know, icons in American history where people need to know that they need to do certain kinds of things to maintain those cars. And that becomes part of the social value of consuming that product. Maybe, you know, one of the examples that you used in your article was Harley Davidson. Harley Davidson has a record in the past of being a more fault-prone motorcycle than some of the Japanese makes. But Harley Davidson also has many attributes that are not associated with Hondas, that they have a very made in America appeal. Honda actually manufactures some motorcycles in the United States, but Harley Davidson manufactures the vast majority of them in the heartland of America. It's been an American brand for a long time.
We made 4 points. I want to respond, and I think we're going to then move to closing statements. Okay. I think we're half hour is going really great. Let's let listeners know. I'm really delighted and respect this man a lot. He's done a wonderful job here. I am having a debate with Gordon Swartz, who had listened to about a month ago. I did an audio kind of an essay on that I thought marketing was evil, and he emailed me and he said, "Would you like to debate it?" And he's come in here and he's been intelligent and thoughtful, and I think he's a perfect model for what we should be doing more in the Bay Area. Whether I agree with him or disagree with him, it's terrible, this echo chamber that we are. We claim to be the most tolerant people, celebrating our diversity, and yet we yell and we scream and we burn down things. I was embarrassed by the Berkeley protests, where not only did they beat people to a pulp, but they and stop the speaker from speaking. What is this Berkeley free play? But one of the most liberal corporations in America is Starbucks. And they burned down the Starbucks. Starbucks was committed to hiring more undocumented immigrants. And this is not what we want. We want the feisty exchange of ideas, respectful. neither Gordon Swartz nor I are benevolent. We are both, we want good for the world. We have very different perspectives. But I am honored that he would be here. And I urge you, more important than whether marketing is evil or marketing is good, is this larger issue of whether a better America is one of censorship or one of the feisty exchange of ideas that the university and radio, especially public radio, is supposed to be the standard bearer for. Now, I need to respond to your points. You talked about Harley-Davidson having a distinct feel. It's an American. It makes people feel American. First of all, that's jingoistic. I consider it wiser people or be wiser to consider themselves world citizens. Why should I have any more solidarity with somebody from Bakersfield than from somebody in Bangladesh? But more important, not only do those Harley ads convince people to buy a Harley versus a Honda, it's convincing people who already have a car to spend $7,000 to $40,000, and that is the price range for Harleys, to buy a car that, despite many fewer miles driven per year, has 27 times the death rate. So it's encouraging people in a way like cancer, like cigarette advertisements, to buy an additional vehicle at great cost to increase their chances of death. That's point one. Point two, you did conflate comfort, driving comfort in a car, with style. No, comfort is very important. But there is no evidence whatsoever that the seats in a Toyota are less comfortable than the seats in a Jaguar or whatever. And believe me, Jaguar is not, when they have that woman draped over the outside of the car, is not talking about the comfort. There is no functional comfort difference. Third, you said that we're not compelling people to buy cars. Of course not, but we're manipulating them. The Madison Avenue brilliant marketers, and those include those who worked on presidential campaigns, know very well that we can manipulate people by identifying their hot buttons. This is not just preferences. No, identifying their desire for sex, for perceived status, for variety of sizzles and not sake, their psychographic elements, everything to distract them from making a rational decision. And finally, you labeled it paternalistic. We don't label it paternalistic when we say that motorcycle riders should wear a helmet. We don't say it's paternalistic when we require all children to attend public schools. We don't say it's paternalistic to say you should take care of your health. Is it really paternalistic to say be caveat emptor and that marketing is out to manipulate you?
Well, I agree absolutely with the last part of your statement that in many markets, it is very, very important for people to be aware of the buyer-seller interactions. As I said kind of at the outset, whenever there's money changing hands, there's opportunity for people to behave unethically or even illegally and to take advantage of someone if they're not sharing information or if there's an asymmetry in terms of power in the situation. But in these markets where we're talking about people can enter freely and exit freely and where the customers, the companies that are providing the products or services in those markets can also enter freely and exit freely, there's this market dynamic that is actually determining what is valued by each of those people in each of those subsegments that you're talking about. You may not care about the comfort of the seat in the luxury car, but someone who is buying that car cares about it. You may not care about the style of the automobile, but the person who sees that automobile and falls in love with the look of it cares about it. And that's a value that they want to exchange. They are willing to exchange money for it. And that's sort of the moment of truth in the marketplace. No one's compelling them to give up their money for a car that doesn't meet a particular model of reliability in miles per gallon or practicality or rationality. They're making a choice which is based on some other set of attributes. So before we close, let me come back to this other example that you mentioned about Golden Gate University. And you did a quick survey of the website and pulled up some pieces of information. So let me just clarify the source. It's not Washingtonian. It's Washington Monthly. And what is very powerful about that Washington Monthly study that you cite is that it's actually one of the very first rankings that has been done in higher education that looks at actual measured performance outcomes. So rather than survey data submitted by the institutions saying this is what our students do and how they behave, This is data that is resident with the Department of Education, and it pertains to what people achieved when they came out of the undergraduate programs at Golden Gate University. So it's real data, and it's authenticated.
It's self-reported. Even though it's by the Department of Ed, it's self-reported by the university. And it really – the main point was that the endorsement was for the overall institution.
But it's not opinion data. It's actually data that's validated.
So is USM the same thing, both self-reported data, iPads and whatever. But anyway.
Well, iPads is so here are some other metrics which you didn't refer to. People who come out of Golden Gate University from the BA programs, they have an average salary of about $65,000. Why? Because they're working and they've accumulated work experience during the time that they've been getting their bachelor's degree. Secondly, people who come out of the Golden Gate University programs, they have a default rate on their loans that is about one-fifth of the average of California default rates on student loans. Why? Because they're working professionals, they're more mature, and they're making a more astute decision. So they're spending less, they come out of the program with less debt, they default at a lower rate, and they have higher salaries. That's a very astute, rational decision from my perspective.
Okay, let's. I'm going to deliberately not respond to that because I think that's a little off topic. Let's stay focused on the marketing question. But I understand in your role, I welcome your having done that. I'm not decrying that at all. That's fine. So, but let's go to closing statements. And I think, in fairness, because you had the first opening statement, I think I'm going to make the first closing statement about whether marketing is innate evil. But I think, and again, in terms of the larger cosmic perspective, I think I've made my arguments as well as I can. What I think I want to do is start to focus on our points of commonality. We agree, certainly, that marketing, when helping a company to develop, marketing should be brought in at the earliest stages in the product's development so that the product can reflect the needs and wants. And I'll stipulate to your point, too, not everything is completely practical and pragmatic. There is some value to the pleasant, to the attractive style, to something that feels good. Even branding, walking through the world, many people, right or wrong, feel better signaling the world by using a brand name. And we haven't talked about wine. So while Consumer Reports rated Two-Buck Chuck, both red and white, as better than more expensive wines, there is something to perception. And when I indeed had a party last night at my house, I didn't serve the cheapest champagne, even if it was the best. I did serve a name brand to signal people that I cared about them. That's marketing. And that is to be legitimately valued. So we share much in common. We certainly agree that in the early development of a product, it's very important to talk to the customer so that the product's characteristics meet the needs and wants of that person. Later on, when there is a worthy product, whether it be worthy on price, whether it be worthy on quality, whether it be worthy on an excellent balance of all of those, marketing is completely justifiable and is an honorable profession. Where we do part company, of course, is the percentage of marketing that ends up getting people to buy products that are more expensive and no better, or more expensive and worse. And I gave many examples of that. The wine here is the first one, but the sneaker example, and they're not trivial differences. The cost of marketing, because it's billions. Oh, I didn't talk about drugs. I knew we need to talk about drugs. You know, generic drug, prescription drugs I'm talking about now, are long been more proven and are off patent, patented the last 17 years. And they're generally, the side effect profiles are better known. The cost is a tiny fraction. But the drug industry in 2015 spent $5.2 billion to market their patented drugs because that's where they make their profits. And they made unprecedented profits. And those products, because they were newer, they are less proven. And they spend billions to get people to convince their doctors to prescribe this very obscenely, it could be $20,000 for a two-month course of treatment. It is, or whether it be sneakers or aspirin or prescription medication or wine or mutual funds. Vanguard is the best mutual fund everybody would argue the cost is lower, the performance is excellent for the cost, and yet they don't advertise very much. A little bit, of course, they all do, but even something as important as your family's financial future, marketing ends up being a net evil, and that's why I make the case, and that's my closing statement. Please, you make yours.
Okay. So this point about being careful and thoughtful about how one spends their money when they're purchasing products and services, whether it's financial services or whether it's products for entertainment, is very important. People, I do think, need to be more thoughtful and rather than reactive or impulsive in the way they spend money, and particularly when it starts to impact things like health. But some of these market environments that we're talking about are extremely complex. When you start to talk about drugs on patents, then you have the question of the organizations that put in the research and the intellectual property to develop treatments and went through years of trials in order to be able to bring a new therapy to the marketplace. Those organizations are trying to generate profits from those drugs in order to be able to pursue additional therapies. The scientists and the chemical engineers and the bioengineers who work in those organizations, they're not doing this because they're profit skimming or that they're trying to gouge patients and consumers. They're doing it because they love their work and they're trying to find ways to solve healthcare problems. So the profits that are being generated for that are related to the intellectual property. And you know, to some extent, when people compare generic drugs with patented drugs, it makes me think about, you know, an artwork. Someone has developed an artwork and then someone else copies it and will sell it to you for a cheaper price. You're completely fine and reasonable to buy the lithograph or to buy the print or to buy the copy. But what you're not doing is you're not recognizing the intellectual property and the creativity of the original creator. So there's some market discontinuity there that we need to be mindful of as consumers and as
a good point.
Healthcare people. So let me come back to this issue about, you know, buying things that are worse for you, because I think that there's a very, very heavily laden value judgment there. When you start to talk about someone who has a car and making a decision to buy a motorcycle, which increases their chance of injury or death, okay, that's one lens. But the other lens is that motorcycling is a sport that many people enjoy. It gives them a sense of freedom. It gives them a sense of adventure. You might as well say we're no longer going to allow people to buy skydiving equipment or to go up in airplanes as private pilots, because those are also extremely risky activities. Or we won't sell scuba diving gear because scuba diving is very, very dangerous.
We're not saying make it illegal. We're talking about marketing it.
But the whole point is marketing it is communicating it about the value of the social activity. And you know, the fact that Honda is doing it and Harley Davidson is doing it and Kawasaki is doing it and Suzuki is doing it and Yamaha is doing it. They're creating a market environment for people to make competitive choices about the differentiated kinds of products that they might buy and then to be able to make a rational decision according to their model of what adds value to their life about which product they will select from that category once they've decided to participate in that category. The same thing about what adds value when you talk about clothing or fashion or sneakers, that maybe it is a brand. Maybe I do want to project that I have a particular fashion orientation. Maybe I want to have a particular standing in my community. Maybe I don't want to serve the generic box of wine in a cardboard box at my dinner party because I am sending a message that I care about them. The human brain is very complex. We form very, very complicated value systems. You cite research that people can't tell the difference between the taste of certain wines, and I would believe that. There's much taste testing that goes on, but taste is not the only thing. When you come to a party, you don't want to bring a cardboard box. You want to bring a nice bottle. You want to make a motion. You want to carry something through. You want to send a message. So that's a very different different value system for what the wine is doing. It's not just the taste. It's not just the functionality. It's the message that it's sending. And that is a legitimate part of a consumer's evaluation. So I think we have to be enormously careful about imposing a single particular model about what is rational when consumers are making the choice. And as long as there's not a major asymmetry in terms of the information being provided, that there's not deception and that there is not coercion in terms of the power of the parties taking place, that the market is the moment of truth when people will come into that marketplace, look at the options in the different categories, and make a choice. And do people always make the wisest choice, even when they think about their own decision-making model? The reality is no.
And it was a good decision for me to have you on the show to have this discussion. I appreciate your proposing the idea. Gordon Swem, and to show my generosity of spirit, I'm going to allow you to do a little marketing right here, right now. But it's got to be really ethical marketing. It's like as though your family and God were looking down upon you. What is one program within the unit? For those of you who are just joining us, this is Work with Marty Nemco. We've had, a very fair-minded debate. Would you agree, by the way, Gordon, when you say this is fair?
I think it's been very interesting and fun.
All right, exactly. And I think enlightening for folks. And much more, again, I like to think that we're modeling what we should be doing here in the Bay Area is having respectful conversations, even when we were quite polar in our views. So Gordon Swartz is the dean of the School of Business at Golden Gate University. Now, if you were to give me a 30-second spot that was completely ethical on one program within the School of Business, I'm sure all of them are wonderful, but pick one that you think is particularly worthy of the 30-second of getting a shout-out. What would it be?
Well, I really don't want to give a commercial, but what I do want to say is that there are two attributes of Golden Gate University that are very, very important to me and why I'm there. As Marty mentioned, I did my MBA at Northeastern University while I was working. And I think that mission of Golden Gate University to provide very practically oriented, valuable education for people who are working and want to keep their jobs is a really, really important part of the offering there. The second thing, it's innovative, that right now we're launching a Master of Science in Business Analytics as an area where there is a tremendous amount of growth. There are lots of jobs and people clamoring for more skills and capability, and that's not going to stop because this is an area where with every single device that you can think of generating streams of data, we have more and more to learn about what we do and how we work together.
And that is a point of agreement. There is no question that data science and data analytics is, for better or worse, probably net better, a part of our future. Gordon Swartz, thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. I think this was great. I was really glad. Thank you again for that great idea to propose the debate.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You bet. We've only got about 10 minutes left, but I want to prioritize you. I could easily go to the phones now and say, well, who do you think won? But again, I'm trying to ask you, rather more helpful, I think at this point, would be to focus on you and your career. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem of any sort, whether you're a clerk or a CEO, for-profit, non-profit, whether you're 16 or 76, the harder the better. I've been doing this for 27 and a half years now. Bring me your hardest problem. I really, really care to help. And the price is right. It's zero, zippo, nada. This is my pro bono work. I don't get paid, and you don't have to pay, but I want to help you. That's what it's about. Got a work problem? Call. Sometimes I'm nice, sometimes I'm tough, but you'll get my authentic me. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Somebody, I'm very, very fortunate that I have a number of listeners who try to email me and share with me something that they think might be relevant to my audience. And this came from a Brandon Nagel. He sent me something. I read the New York Times often, but I missed this piece, and he sent it to me. It was great. And it just came out to Thursday. And this is a quote. Almost half of people in their early 20s have a secret. One they usually don't share even with their friends. Their parents help them pay the rent. Moving into adulthood has never been easy, but America's rapidly changing labor market is making it harder to find economic security at a young age. Skilled work is increasingly concentrated in high-rent metropolitan areas, so more young people are tapping into their parents' bank accounts. A theme that I have stressed on this show for a long time. Because there is ever greater cost of hiring an American with Obamacare or its replacement, with paid family leave, with workers' compensation, with Medi-Cal, with Medicare, all of these huge increased Social Security limits, employers, especially in the Bay Area, because we know that in the Bay Area there's a tremendous anti-corporate feel. The employers are part-timing, temping, offshoring, or nearshoring to South Carolina or low-cost countries so much work. And that's why I urge you, if you are at all, if you are not entrepreneurial, the last bastion of predominantly full-time benefited jobs is government. Get into a into the government system and get a government job, because then once you're in, you get tremendous brownie points, bonus points in making lateral moves. And if you are at all entrepreneurial, I urge you to learn about starting a small business. And it is not getting a degree program. Go and do a boot camp. Go, the Small Business Administration offers free workshops on how to start a small business. Do not follow the MBA route, which says get scalable, because the more scalable the business, the more complex and the more likely you are to fail. They say it takes my MBA programs say it takes money to make money. No, very often what that does is it screws with your cash flow, and when you make the inevitable new entrepreneur mistakes, you're going to go out of business. What you want to do, and always MBA programs focus on the status fields like high tech and biotech and whatever. Focus on the unsexy. Status is the enemy of contentment. If you end up choosing a small business where the competition is weak in the low status professions, whether it's being in mobile home park maintenance or used truck park brokerage or selling flowers out of a cart, those are relatively low business cost businesses to start, and your competition isn't the brilliant people of Silicon Valley on Sand Hill Road. Learn the essence of basic, simple entrepreneurship. And if you are starting that flower cart, of course you're not going to get rich from that. And you don't need to get rich. You just need to make $150,000 a year. That's enough to live even in the Bay Area. Clone it. Once you are running this excellent flower cart right next to a BART station or a Caltrans station or whatever, then you find a friend of yours who's reliable, honorable, kind, and you let that person manage that stand and you open another. And you keep cloning that simple business that is not subject to trend risk, doesn't have huge cash flow problems, and you open 3, 4, or 5 until you're netting $150,000 while still paying your workers well. That may be in the generation coming forward, in the arc of your career, as these jobs are going to be ever good, full-time benefited corporate jobs are going to be ever more scarce, unless you're a star. Learn ethical, simple, clonable, shoestring business entrepreneurship. That may be the smartest path if you even have a scintilla of proclivity toward entrepreneurship. Now let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Hello.
Do you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, great. Please don't hang up on me because I may have a dissenting point of view.
I don't hang up on dissent. I only hang up on people where I think it's redundant or not that wise a possession. But there are many intelligent disagreements. Let's hear yours.
Yeah, okay. You say that, but I've experienced otherwise. But
yeah, I do. I do cut off callers who I feel where my listeners are better served by somebody else. Yep.
Yeah. Let me just say a couple of things. You often give very sound advice when it comes to where to look for jobs and how to resolve career transitions. And I think that's where you're really strong. But when you turn into an ideologue, you're less effective. You're often very superior.
Watch the labeling. That's what's called ad hominem. Calling somebody an ideologue and superior. Make a specific comment.
Okay, let me just, you repeat yourself a lot, like you say with this marketing. Well, you've said several times that we live in a bubble, that we don't engage in argument and discourse like you do with your guests and your wife, and where you see both sides of the story. That's just not true.
Again, you're being general. Make a
specific about the Bay Area. Okay. That's just not true.
Oh, okay. And would you care to make a specific, please, and tell me? In my experience, I have seen a tremendous amount of intolerance, and I gave an example of the Berkeley.
Yeah.
There was a speaker, Yano Mayanopoulos, or whatever his name is, was a gay guy, a Republican, who was not allowed to speak, and not only was shouted down, but they beat up his supporters in the street, and they burned down a liberal store. I was not being general.
You grossly generalized, I think.
Where was the generalization? I'm giving a highly specific example from this week.
That's one example, Marty, out of many. I mean, there's a history here of free speech and people speaking out for their beliefs.
And the history is born.
What
I'm seeing right now is not a free speech. What I'm hearing is, I swear on my mother's life.
Oh,
I can tell you that so many people, when they mention the name Donald Trump, They say, I would assassinate him if I had a gun. I swear at least four people. Is that not right?
I don't know. I don't know those people, and I've never heard anybody say that. I know he brings out a lot of very strong feelings in people for sometimes good reasons. It's outrageous that he happens to be our face to the world and that he represents us, because he has absolutely clearly lied, you know, over and over again. And so,
okay, this is, I am going to interrupt you because this is completely off topic for the show. The show is about work, so I will thank you for the call. No. You know, the call was started with a series of ad hominem criticisms that were completely general, not having anything to do with career, when I specifically asked for people who got a work-related problem. Anyway, we have so little time left that I want to just offer a couple of tips. Another listener, her name is Allie Lowry. She wrote a request. She didn't send me an article to comment about, but she asked me to talk about how to go about delegating work to subordinates, to peers, and to bosses. Of course, that's a complicated question, but I want to present a very specific idea that I think is a really good rule of thumb. As long as it's ethical, ask for what you want. So in other words, if you really feel, if the goddess within you says you really are working too hard, or given tasks that really aren't in your skill set, and you feel that you would do a better job if you had either less tasks, because you really were working 10 or 12 hours a day and too much, or you were given tasks that really are not the best use of your skill, it is completely right to ask for what you want. Go to your boss, and in a calm, hopefully non-accusatory way, by making that point to the person. Or if you feel like it's appropriate to delegate, most people don't want to take on more work. And so you really, if at all possible, I'll try to role play here, again, being very specific. If I had a supervisee or a coworker that I wanted to offload some of my work to, I would probably word it something like this. Mary, I'm feeling even a little guilty or self-conscious even about bringing this up to you. But I feel like I'm over my head. I'm working 12 hours a day. I can't get it all done. Probably some of it is my weaknesses or whatever. But there's this particular set of tasks that I'm not even that good at, and it takes me particularly long, and I see how good you're at that kind of stuff. Would you kill me if I asked you to take on some of this? Do you have any bandwidth where you might be able to take it on? I think that kind of a honest, face-saving, very human approach is the way in which one can delegate successfully without being seen as a shirker. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank you all for listening. And even that one call, you know, I was unfortunate. She brought out the worst in me, because I just felt she was an emblematic of exactly what's wrong with the kind of communication. Ad hominem arguments that are off topic and shrugging her shoulders and sighing, you know, and it just it does concern me. That is one of my most deeply held beliefs, that even when views differ, as I did with Gordon Swartz, that we really had an intelligent, there wasn't one bit of name calling. It was all on the substance. And then as a result, all of the issues, or at least a lot of the issues, came by. And we're ending up, despite the agreement, we shook hands at the end, and we're going to come off the air, and we're going to feel good about it. And human relationships, and we use the common Bay Area word community, has been furthered by that, despite our very feisty exchange. I urge that for you. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers and careers in an under-the-radar field. This will not be controversial. Packaging. It's a really, you would think it's not an innovative career. It's the career is really exploding and very interesting, and even environmentally responsible. Till next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.